You are listening to episode 13 of season 9 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and as I just said, this is GNU World Order. In this series, in this podcast, we talk about technology, computers, specifically Unix, or rather Linux, sometimes BSD and Solaris and Delumos and things like that, but mostly Linux. And in this episode, we're going to take a break from Python, which we've been doing in the past couple of episodes. So in this episode, I thought we might take a little bit of a break from that and just get back to the usual rambling. Not because Python is bad, it's just it becomes very intense, and if you're not following along, hearing me rattle off line after line of Python does get a little bit boring. So this is for all of you people who are not typing furiously as I read lines of Python to you, which is okay. So in this episode, we're going to talk about, well, of course, we're going to talk about the cloud. And yeah, I say that with the emblazoned quotes around the cloud. We're going to delve right into it. And we'll probably talk a little bit about OwnCloud. We'll talk about TCSH and Bash. We'll talk about a couple of other things. So let's jump right into it. Well, first, of course, we're going to talk about listener feedback. And I got two listener feedbacks, both of which are quite good. One is from Ken Fallon. You know Ken Fallon. He hosts my websites, or some of them, I think. He basically resurrected HPR. So yes, you know Ken. So Ken wrote me and asked me what on earth I was talking about when I said the Imperial Measuring System was based on, like, hex. Yeah, I wasn't speaking literally. I was saying that in my mind, I think of the Imperial System in groups of four. And that's not hex, that's whatever it is, quad or something, I don't know. So groups of four, but then of course you have four groups of four, and that eventually gets you sort of to hex, right? So I was just saying that that's how I deal with Imperial, and I think many Americans do. I think if you ask an American for sort of the breakdown of common measurements, they'll tell you things like, well, there are four quarts in a cup. No, there aren't four quarts in a cup. There are four quarts in a gallon. There are four, I had another example, and then I lost it because I screwed up the cup thing. Oh, four teaspoons in a tablespoon. Little things like that. So, and even, I mean, the fact that we talk about, like, quarter of an inches, that's kind of like in I think most American minds, we kind of break them into quarters, so the smallest system of measurement we have, more or less, is a quarter of an inch. If you ask anyone about, you know, something smaller than that, it gets complicated for our brains to process it. And sometimes you'll hear about eighth of an inch, and sometimes you'll hear about sixteenth of an inch, not usually. But there you go, I mean, that's what I'm telling you. It's like we break them down into four, groups of four. That's all I meant. And I could be wrong, I mean, maybe I'm the only American who does that, but it's my perception that that's what we do. So there you go. That was all I was saying. And I got another email from Jonathan Nadeau. He's the guy who runs, well, the Accessible Computing Foundation, which if you don't know about that, you should, and you should probably check out their website. It's run by Jonathan. Its only goal, its exclusive goal, is to promote and to enact accessibility in free software, and that's really, really important. I'm not even going to say it's important, like, to get people on Linux or whatever. It's just important. I mean, really, it's important for a lot of different reasons, and it is accessiblecomputingfoundation.org. I got there eventually. Anyway, that's not why Jonathan emailed me, but he did email me an accessibility-related question, which was, he pointed out that the Pygame stuff that I was doing was very interesting, but pretty much exclusive to people with sight, with vision. So he suggested a sonic-driven game, which I think is an absolutely fascinating idea, and I'm working on some kind of example that we might be able to do together in a later episode with Python that would make that possible. So there you go. And this is a great point, the whole accessibility thing. The nice thing about being able to program and generate applications is that you can actually think about, okay, how is this going to be accessible? How is this going to work? Unfortunately, I don't know a whole lot about the accessibility aspect of the Qt framework, which is really, really kind of interesting, and I would really, really like to know more about it. So it's kind of something that I'm going to start researching in earnest now, because it's a great framework. It's cross-platform. I love it. It's got, obviously, C++ bindings plus the Python bindings, so that's really, really handy, but who knows what it acts like around screen readers. So that's something that I'm going to start looking into now, so that I can have better answers later and even maybe address it as I continue. So that's Jonathan. Thanks for the feedback, everyone. And now we're going to move on to the topic of the cloud. I don't know many real geeks, or at least what I would think of as real geeks, who are at all enamored or excited, truly excited about the cloud. Most real hardcore geeks who are the geeks designing the systems that we use or programming the systems that we use, most of them seem to know that the term the cloud is a buzzword, that it is meaningless, and that it really just refers to a couple of different technologies like redundancy and high availability and things like that, and rolled it up into this sort of magical thing that everyone is now calling a cloud. And, you know, cloud is a very flexible term as well, right? Because, I mean, to me and Deep Geek and Lost in Bronx and Sigflup, quote, the cloud is a place that we have on a server in some faraway land, and that's where we host our little server that we have together, and we put our files onto it, and we, you know, it's available to us from all over the place, and that's our own little private cloud. It's not, of course, a cloud; it's a server. But the term cloud, quote unquote, has kind of become like the place that I work online, and that's kind of what the cloud sort of means to a lot of people, because to the user, that is kind of what the cloud is. You know, people are saying, well, what's the cloud? How can I use it? And everyone says, oh, use Google Docs. You know, and that's, oh, that's the cloud. Or, oh, use Google Drive. Hey, that's the cloud. And it doesn't really mean anything about the infrastructure, which is typical. Yes, that's usually how it works. People say, I want a computer. And people say, here, have this computer. And no one thinks about, like, what's actually on the computer. It's just whatever you're handed, you start using it. And then that's the thing that you get used to, and bang, you're off. That's you. That's for the rest of your life. That's your computer. So a cloud is a very kind of malleable and flexible term, I think, in the same way, at least in the unofficial kind of common vernacular. In my mind, cloud has become kind of this cop-out sort of way, in at least in the sense of the question of cross-platform. You know, everyone's kind of like, oh, the OS doesn't matter anymore. The operating system is deprecated. No one cares about the OS because all your applications are on the cloud or are going to be on the cloud. And everyone kind of continually thinks that just we're all going to start moving towards this cloud, where we're going to do all of our work, we're going to have all of our applications. Well, we're not going to have the applications at all, right? They're going to be on the server. We're not going to have to think about that. We're just going to launch things, again, from the cloud. And this is messy business, because there are a lot of implications, and no one's actually saying what they have in mind when they say, okay, you're going to start using the cloud now. There's not, luckily, a singular agenda of the cloud. Different people have different solutions. There are online video editing applications now, but it's not as if though everyone's saying, okay, even the big hardcore applications are going to be literally cloud-based. Some companies are moving to what they call a cloud, and all they mean is you need to be online all the time so that we can authenticate your license, which, by the way, is a great, great thing. I love that for proprietary software, forcing people to be online all the time in order to authenticate their license. It's the best way to push people into free software, honestly. It's fantastic. And this is going to be a huge side thing now, but I have to say it. If, and I've pretty sure I've said this before, but I'm just going to say it again. If the music, I mean, think about the music and the movie business, and think about how they have absolutely demonized anyone who downloads music or movies, quote unquote, illegally. I mean, it's literally, if you talk to a person out on the street today, like a kid even, like, I mean, a high school student, sadly, even the high school students who, you know, traditionally are supposed to be the rebels, right? And you say to them, "Oh, I've got this copy of this movie. Would you like to watch it?" A shocking number of them will be like, "Oh, no, I don't pirate." And that's what they say. I mean, they've bought the thing hook, line, and sinker. The movie and the music industry, they've absolutely made it. They've done a hard sell of this idea that if you steal an album or if you steal a movie, it is like you are stealing a car or a purse or a bike or whatever, soul. And you should never do it. And people are buying into that. That's, you know, and for a while it was neck and neck. Well, for a while it was totally opposite. I mean, people just thought, okay, it's online. I'm going to download it. I don't care what anyone says. And that was how it was. And then it became neck and neck. I mean, it seemed like there was a push towards saying that it was utter piracy and that it was a criminal act that is tantamount to piracy, like literal piracy, like boarding a ship and killing people and stealing their gold. And there was this pushback. There was this movement saying, no, it's not the same thing. It's you know, it's not. It isn't illegal. It isn't piracy. There's a lot of reasons that it's not, you know, especially since we're not actually taking physical goods, but also because the studios and the music studios and the movie studios are the ones getting all of the money anyway. It's not like we're even taking money from the artists. We're taking money from these big corporations that have too much money and then still claim that they had a financial loss on, you know, an album or a movie that made $1 billion. But it seems to me, at least in my world view, in my little bubble, it seems like they've basically won out at this point. It's really, really condemned to download music and movies without paying someone for them. You know, feel about that what you will. My point actually isn't about that. My point is that if the music and the movie industry was able to do that, probably with just a couple of million dollars, I mean, it didn't take them much, a couple of trailers in front of the movies, a couple of commercials, it doesn't, you know, pay off a couple of people to be outspoken about it. Plant a couple of news stories about how, you know, an 80-year-old grandmother got arrested because she downloaded a Frank Sinatra album or a Perry Como or whoever album, Henry Mancini, let's go with Mancini album, and so she got arrested or something, you know, and then people are down with it. Okay, they mean business. It really is illegal. We understand why it's wrong. Now, if they were able to do that, you're telling me that big software companies can't do the same thing. I mean, the reason that the software applications that are proprietary are so popular and rampant is because obviously they enable people to use them without being licensed. It's so blatantly obvious, it's embarrassing that no one else sees this. There are so many different ways. I mean, there are dongles, there are, you know, demanding that you're online all the time. There are so many different ways to not have people steal your software. And yet, so many companies just don't do it. They don't bother actually actually making it a thing. And if the technology, if you're afraid that the technology wouldn't uphold all the hackers trying to get around the licensing, which of course it wouldn't, but if you're afraid of that, then do a smear campaign on the whole idea and tell people you may not use this application, this popular application, without paying for it. And not only paying for it, but paying like a grand for it every time we release it. And that's just your duty as a upright citizen. And trust me, things will change. I mean, we've seen it change with music and movies. So the fact that the software companies supposedly can't do that, and they're supposedly so upset with people stealing their software, it's kind of, it's a lark. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So, proprietary software finally jumping on board the online all the time licensing scheme is truly one of the best things that could happen to free software, and I love it. And I encourage Adobe and Microsoft and Apple and all the big ones, I want them to just make sure that no one can use their software without paying for it. Because, I mean, that's right. That's moral. That's ethical. People should pay for the software if the companies are asking for money. From the bottom of my heart, I mean that. Now, that was my side topic about licensing and how ridiculous it is that no one enforces licensing. And that's why, of course, the free software stuff, you know, LibreOffice and GIMP and Inkscape, all these things look suddenly, you know, they don't look as appealing until suddenly every time you try to launch your stolen software, it won't let you do it because you don't actually have a license. But the actual thing that I'm talking about, if I may segue back to my main topic, was the cloud. And the cloud, being something that's very muddled in definition, I don't think it really matters what the actual definition of it is, but I have been noticing that a big thing about the cloud and about sort of people promoting the cloud is that supposedly the operating system that you are using is no longer important. You don't need to know the operating system. Now, unfortunately, the undercurrent to many of these kinds of statements online, in my view, It feels to me, it smells a bit like they just mean Mac versus Windows. They're not actually saying that it's operating system agnostic, because operating system agnostic would be Mac, Windows, Linux, BSD, Haiku, Helen OS, you name it. I can't think of all the ones that I've Plan 9, you know, just keep going, right? That would be platform agnostic, and they don't really mean that. They mean Mac or Windows, sadly. But it does strike me that the cloud is starting to become kind of like this cop-out, easy way toward quote-unquote cross-platform. And that kind of disappoints me, because the cloud is this idea that people are trying to sell, and it's got these questionable motives behind it. And along with those questionable motives, like we're going to own your data, we're going to own your applications, we don't have to provide the source code because it's on our servers and all you are doing is opening a portal into our server. All these motives that a cloud may have, they're rolling into that sort of questionable motive. They're rolling into that something that's pure and good and clean and nice, which is the ideal of cross-platform. Now, as you know, if you've listened to me for a while, I'm a big fan of cross-platform. Cross-platform is something that I treasure and cherish above quite a lot else. Not everything, not all else, but I really, really respect cross-platform, because I do believe cross-platform is important. I believe it's phenomenally important, and not just for self-serving motives, although there is some of that, because as everyone has said who's ever done a Linux podcast, if you give people cross-platform applications, then ask, you know, then telling them, hey, you could use Ubuntu or Magia or something underneath the free applications that you already use, it's not such a stretch. I mean, they would be launching Firefox, they would be playing things in VLC, they would be writing in LibreOffice, they would be, I don't know, doing what else, whatever else other people do on computers. It would all be the same, and the OS truly wouldn't matter. And that's kind of where I'm going with this, that the answer to cross-platform, the avenue to cross-platform should not be the cloud. It should not be, we're going to own all of your data and your applications, and you're going to be nothing but a consumer and with really no rights at all. The answer to cross-platform should be, we're going to make things cross-platform. Now, in my youth, which I admit was muddled and confused, in my youth, I used to think that when software didn't work on the computer platform of my choice at that time, it wasn't my fault, I was born into it. I blame my parents. I figured when something wouldn't work on the platform of my choice, I figured, you know, I blamed the other guys. I thought, well, you're stupid for not making your program work on my platform. And while there's some truth to that, now that I am vaguely sometimes, you know, I play with programming, I do a lot of computer support, things like that, I realize that the ability to obtain the certain platforms is just so impossible. I mean, it's just so expensive and so, I mean, you just can't do it. And so for a programmer to be able to program for your platform of choice may literally be restrictive. They just may not be able to do it because the platform of your choice has made it intentionally difficult for them to do that. Now, later on, when I started doing a little bit of programming here and there, I started to see that that actually making things cross-platform, if you're choosing the correct tools, I mean, you see things like KDE and Qt and Python and Blender and Firefox and VLC and all these other things, it becomes really obvious pretty quickly that being cross-platform is not that hard. I'm not saying it's trivial by any means. But I am saying that if the stacks that you're using start out as cross-platform friendly, then it becomes a lot easier for the people up the chain, or maybe that's downstream, I don't know, to actually go cross-platform as well. So what's going on when things aren't cross-platform? I think in some cases, it is a stubbornness on the programmer's part. I think I don't think that happens in the independent software sector so much. I think it happens in the corporate world that, you know, they don't want to make programs cross-platform because they want vendor lock-in. Kind of obvious. Other times I think it is, again, because of the corporate sort of sector and their motives, it's rather impossible to get into that framework in order to make your program talk to it. It's just you don't have access to the tools that you need because you would have to purchase a ridiculous license for a programming environment, or you would have to purchase a ridiculous computer or whatever. So there's just kind of that practical, the reality of not, you know, not giving people access to your code so that they can make sure that their stuff works on your platform. So I think that being cross-platform, it takes resolve, it takes determination on a lot of different levels. You know, obviously the lower it starts in the stack, the easier it is as you get further down the stack or up the stack. But the thing that has really, really, I guess, totally pushed me over the edge on, okay, cross-platform is really, really possible, was shockingly, the game industry. So the game industry for a very long time, I mean, for as long as I've been on Linux, which has been quite a while now, gaming on Linux was kind of that sore spot. And to to some degree, I guess it still is. It's not exactly where it needs to be yet, but as you probably know, Valve announced the Steam Machine, and the Steam Machine and the Steam OS is going to be a Linux-based, well, it is. There's a beta right now. You can go download it. Steam OS is a Linux-based operating environment, operating system, exclusively for Steam games. I mean, that's what it's intended to be. You get the Steam Machine computer, or you can build your own and load Steam OS onto it, and put it in your living room and make that your console. I have not tried it yet. I'm going to try it as soon as I get around to it, but from what I'm understanding, you know, you'll start it up and it will be like a console. I don't know, it might boot up to a desktop or something, but I kind of doubt it. From what I understand, it's more like an XBMC for gaming, you know, that kind of thing. So, SteamOS, Linux-based. If this was anyone else, it probably wouldn't make that much of a splash, but this is Valve. I mean, this is a big, sort of popular, famous company in gaming culture, and they're putting their weight behind this. So that's a big deal. And I knew it was a big deal when I first heard it, but wasn't really sure what to make of it. And then slowly things start coming out for Linux. Games that have existed, you know, on console only or only for PC, Windows, I mean, start coming out for Steam, on Steam for Linux. And I'm not talking about, you know, the little retro or indie arcade games or the indie platformers. I mean, they probably led the way, but I mean, I'm talking about things like Metro, Last Light, what was the other one just the other day? Something, a Witcher, I guess. I don't know if that's that big of a deal. I don't know. I can't think of them right now because I'm not really that invested in gaming, but it's happening. Like big, what they call AAA titles are coming to Linux. And it was just kind of like, it's not overnight, but relatively overnight. And if you remember, I mean, the argument used to be, well, it wouldn't be worth the investment. It's too hard to port things to Linux. It couldn't be done. It's too much to maintain. The Linux is changing too much, and we could never support Linux. All these excuses for not releasing games on Linux suddenly somehow evaporated overnight, just gone. And they did try to pass it off as like a technical limitation. I mean, sometimes it was just, okay, not enough money in it, you know, not enough people to justify that kind of investment. And that's probably, honestly, the most true one. But it annoys me that it was ever a story of, oh, well, Linux just has too many different releases. We could never support that. As if though they were absolutely obligated to put out Debs, RPMs, tar packages, you know, and every other kind of package known to man. It was always like these silly sort of pseudo-technical excuses that would evaporate under two conditions. One, that the game would be ported by Iculus, who somehow had this magic touch of just making porting a game possible, whereas other game companies kept insisting it couldn't be done. Again, obviously ridiculous. Iculus basically proved that incorrect, but, you know, I guess that's an investment, so there's that argument still. And then the second condition, of course, is, well, Valve, SteamOS. So in the broader point here is I don't believe in the inability to create cross-platform software. I understand that cross-platform, literally for every existing operating system, given that, you know, every college probably has a computer science person sort of designing their own, like, little, you know, 8-bit operating system or something, I realize that that's not probably something that you can necessarily guarantee. It's, you know, it's not necessarily going to run on Mic OS. So I get that, but certainly for the operating systems that are in wide use, and I'm talking about wide use, like the internet consists primarily of Unix servers, and developers around that culture and that business frequently are using Unix-based or Unix-like operating systems. So getting stuff to be cross-platform across like the big four or five operating systems is something that we can do. I know it is. I mean, Java programmers know that it is. So it's something that can happen. And saying that the operating system no longer matters because of the cloud is disingenuous. I don't think that's actually the point of the cloud. I don't believe that it's in there at the core of their belief system to make everything cross-platform. I think that proponents of the cloud have many, many other reasons for promoting the cloud, and cross-platform isn't actually one of them. Now, on the flip side of all this, as I've said, I kind of have a little cloud of my own with some friends, and it's not really a cloud, but I also have my own personal cloud. In fact, one might call it my own cloud, and in fact, of course, that is what I'm using, own cloud. Own cloud, I think I may have talked about before, maybe not, I think I have, but own cloud is, I mean, it's been a really promising project from the very start, and that's largely what it has been, is promising. And there have been lots of problems with past versions, not lots of problems, I should say there have been little wrinkles in past versions that kept me kind of like backing away, because some of the features that it hadn't quite nailed yet were actually the features that I was looking at it for, so that didn't work for me that well. But lately I've gotten into a place where it's actually been really, really handy to have a cloud environment, and I say cloud in this sort of flexible definition of cloud, and basically it just means online. This environment that belongs to me, that runs on my own server, that enables me to do a lot of work that I can't do otherwise. Maybe I can't SSH for some reason, or maybe I can't, I don't know, do whatever. Maybe I'm on a computer where I'm not comfortable saving my personal data, whatever the case might be. OwnCloud has recently become really, really, really important to me, and it's been performing fantastic. I can't speak highly of it enough of it at this point. The files that you can create on an OwnCloud install are fantastic. I do a lot of text-based stuff, so I can do text documents. I can do HTML with format highlighting. I can do normal file management kinds of operations with my files. It splits it out into music and pictures for me as well. I've got contact list. I've got a calendar. I'm actually using a calendar for a change and syncing it to Thunderbird. It's just fantastic. It's really, really come a long way. I'm not going to say that it's perfect, but that's only because nothing is perfect, and I probably wouldn't say that any solution is perfect. So, I mean, OwnCloud sometimes, I mean, the response time is weird on the calendar. I add a new event, and it takes a moment for it to pop up, or to refresh its display and show me all the events, that kind of thing. Not really a deal breaker, and it might just be because of the server that I'm running it on. I think there was another issue that I had, something about shared calendars or something not quite working the way that I thought they should work, but I haven't really invested that much time into it either, so I could be wrong. All I know is that OwnCloud at this point has come such a long way that it's really, really a pleasure to use, and a good long while I was running a lot of stuff off of thumb drives. Like, I was really, really invested in live CDs on thumb drives. I was going around at computers and doing all kinds of stuff. I do a little bit of that still, just for articles that I write and when I need a test environment, but it's not like it used to be. I mean, it used to be that I mean, at one point I was almost at the point where I did not need a computer of my own, because I could almost guarantee that I was going to be around a computer that I could reboot and boot into Slacks and do all the necessary work that I needed to do. Kind of a big shift for me now. But OwnCloud has made everything possible. About the only thing that it's missing for me right now, I guess, is an integrated email client. But I haven't really looked into that a whole lot, so that might even exist. And if not, I guess mailpile.is might be something to look into for me. I'm not sure. But the point is, OwnCloud is really, really great. If you've checked it out any time ago, you should check it out again. If you weren't, you know, if it wasn't what you needed at that point, take another look at it, because it has come a long, long way. Hey, it's time for a cup of coffee. Why not go get yourself one? Take a couple of sips, and then get ready, because we're about to talk about TCSH. Okay, let's talk about TCSH then. TCSH is, if you didn't know, the sort of successor of CSH, which is more commonly called the C shell. So TCSH is, well, it would be like Bash, or actually it'd be more like C shell, but it's a terminal, right? Or it's a shell. So when you open up a terminal, usually on most Linux distributions, you get Bash. That's the black screen with green text on it. That's usually Bash. It could be something simpler, like Dash, but it's usually, or Ash, but it's usually Bash. And so a lot of the things that we take for granted in a terminal really is a Bash thing. It's a Bash convention. You can have arguments about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I tend to think that the Bash conventions are quite nice, but it is good to be aware of what is a Bash convention versus what is not, so that you know when you're doing a shell script, for instance, is this going to work in another shell? Now, I'll be honest, I really have no reason, no personal reason to use TCSH. I don't have any need to use it on an everyday basis, except that lately I have been. Not really by choice. It's something that has been imposed upon me, and I'm kind of a sucker for new applications. I do like to try new things in software. So I didn't really mind having TCSH imposed upon me. My overall feeling about TCSH is that it does seem to be good, seems to work, but I will say that at home I still use Bash. So kind of, you know, if that gives you a sense for its impact on my life, I guess that's kind of it. So there are a couple of different things about TCSH that you could try, if for some reason you wanted to try TCSH, and honestly, I'm not even sure the advantages of TCSH. From the things that I see online and kind of understand from people, it's kind of historical. It's almost like, did you grow up with CSH? Here, try TCSH, because TCSH, as I've said, is sort of it's kind of the improved version, I guess, of CSH. I believe its history is rooted in either CMU or MIT. They kind of took C shell and redid it as TCSH with, I think, a better license or something like that. I'm not sure. And again, I'm not really sure exactly why people like it. I think I heard once that it, quote, has a more C-like syntax, whatever that means. So I'm a user of TCSH now, and it's fun to try new software. So I'm going to kind of talk about some of the little differences in TCSH versus Bash, just kind of as a matter of curiosity. And if you want to try it, like I say, give it a shot. It's kind of interesting. So the first thing that you may notice in TCSH, at least if you're using something like URXVT, which is kind of my terminal of default, terminal of choice, if you're using something like that, you'll probably notice that the backspace key does not do the backing of spaces. It doesn't delete like you would think it would. It actually echoes, I think, some weird sort of I think it might be caret H. Could be wrong about that. But it doesn't backspace. It doesn't delete. So if you want that to work, you need to issue the command tset. That is T-S-E-T. That's not test. It's T-S-E-T. Space dash E. And that sets the backspace key as the valid deletion, backwards deletion key. You could also just forego modern keyboards and use Control H for back deletions and Control D for forward deletions and just do that. Which, honestly, I'm trying to get in the habit of doing it because it is kind of nice to just have that ingrained. But anyway, let's see. In Bash, of course, to set your prompt, you probably know it's PS1 equals quote, $:, quote. That would set your prompt to a dollar sign. TCSH, you simply set prompt equals quote, $:, quote. And that would set your prompt to just a dollar sign. So any of these options, of course, as you could probably guess, you could put into a .chrc file in your home folder, and that is just like your bashrc folder, except for C shell, or tcsh in this case. But yeah, it's .chrc. And so you can put options in there, and every time you launch a new shell, it will read in things like tset-e and set prompt and things like that. You can always also set no clobber, which I rather like. No clobber sets it such that when you redirect something, so if you're doing, list/bin, redirect into, mybin.txt, if mybin.txt already exists, it will tell you, sorry, it already exists, I'm not going to overwrite that file. If you want it to overwrite the file, you can do a greater than sign and then an exclamation mark, and that forces it to overwrite. That forces a clobber, but the default action will be set no clobber. And I don't even know what the equivalent of that is in Bash, to be honest. I have not looked into that at all, to set that as my default. It seems kind of like a good default to have, actually. Let's see. So as you may be getting, variables are set with the word set. So in Bash, whereas you would do something like foo equals bar, you wouldn't do that in TCSH. You would do something like set foo equals bar. And then foo would equal bar. And there are some kind of cool little tricks that you can do with variables in TCSH, just like there are lots of tricks that you can do with variables in Bash, like arrays and lists and things like that. But in TCSH, you've got, for instance, set arg equals paren foo space bar space baz, close paren. So you've just set the string arg, A-R-G, like arguments, arg to a list of foo and then bar and then baz. So then you can actually get, you can look at that list of variables in a couple of different ways. So you can get, for instance, the first value by doing echo $arg square bracket 1 square bracket, and that would return foo. You might think, are you sure it's not bar? Well, yes I am, because in TCSH, the variable count does not start at 0, it starts at 1. Go figure. You could also find out how many arguments or how many variables are in the list with echo $:, or pound or hash, whatever, ARG. And that would tell you, in this case, 3, because there are 3 variables in your list. And then finally, you can see if the variable is set at all or not, and do it's echo $:? ARG. And that would return 1 if it is set or 0 if it is not set. So if you hadn't used arg yet, then you would get a 0 back and you would know that it was safe to assign a value to arg. Or if you were checking to see if some other thing had assigned values to arg and it returns zero, then you would know that no, it had not done that yet, and that you need to wait for some other process or whatever. I'm just coming up with ways that you might use it. The other interesting thing that's not a variable, but it kind of is, or it is in Bash. Like in Bash, I don't know if you know this, but if you do a read, READ, this means that it will get input from the user and assign it to a value, to a variable. So if you just open up a terminal, if you're in front of one, open up Bash, if you do the word read, READ, let's just capital DATA, all capital, and then semicolon, and then we'll say echo $data, all capitals. Okay, so it's read data, semicolon, echo data. So then I hit return, and the weird thing is that nothing happens. It just, you get no prompt, nothing. You just got a cursor. Now if I type in a word, like clat2, and then hit return, it's going to take clat2 and assign it to the variable data, and then after the semicolon, obviously I said echo data back to me, so it should just repeat clat2 at me. And sure enough, it did. So I've got read data, semicolon, echo data, and then clat2, which I typed, and then clat2, which it echoed, and then I'm back at my bash string. TCSH, it doesn't happen that way. It may be doing variable stuff behind the scene, but it doesn't feel the same way. So what you could do is, for instance, is echo, quote, enter your name, \n, close quote, space, %, and then set your name equals paren $ <= close paren. That's really weird. It sounds weird. You probably have no idea what we just did. But so what we did was we echoed into your name, and then we also forced a line break because we did a \n in, which the shell is going to interpret as a line break. Closed the quote for that, so that's one thing. And then we did %, to give it a new command once that one's complete, and we'll say set your name equals, and then this is the really weird part, it's paren $ <= paren. And that in TCSH language, the $less than is saying take the input and sort of direct it into this variable that we're now setting. Set your name equals and then this input. So it's a variable, but it's basically a redirect of standard in to that variable, which feels a lot different, I think. But it is actually the same thing if you think about it. So then if we hit return after we type that, we get enter your name, and then we could type in clat2, and then hit return, and nothing happens because I didn't tell it to do anything. But now if I echo $ your name, sure enough, I get clat2 back. So that's how you do that in TCSH. And obviously there are lots of other things that you can do in TCSH. There are different, translations between Bash and TCSH that you would need to know about if you were going to do serious TCSH work. I've not done a whole lot of serious work in TCSH. It's just my terminal. It's just my shell, rather. It's not something that I need to script for or anything like that. So I don't really do a whole lot in it, but it is different, and it will catch you off guard when you least expect it. You know, little things that you get used to. I'm very, very used to doing things like really little simple for loops, just one-liners, you know, for q in *.png, semicolon convert, you know, semicolon done. I'm really used to doing that sort of thing, and in TCSH, that's not how it's done. For is an unknown command. It just freaks out. So you can't do proper functions in TCSH. And, you know, it depends on where you stand, I guess, with your shell stuff. I mean, do you think a shell should be able to do that, or do you not? I don't know. I like Bash. I happen to find it very useful. I find a lot of its features very, very handy. And I guess some other people find TCSH preferable. So I don't know. I just think it's interesting to actually have gotten to the point where I'm actually using a different shell for a change and actually using it on a daily basis and getting to know those little differences, because that's what I like. I like to get to know the little differences between applications that I use. It's cool. It's really fun. The other thing I should mention about TCSH is that you don't do $paren to execute things. You have to use the backticks. So that's kind of another interesting thing right there. And I think it does lists differently, too. I don't think you can do, like, curly braces like you can in Bash when you're telling it to do multiple things. So, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. Check it out if you feel like you're really comfortable in Bash and you just kind of want to mix it up a bit. TCSH exists. It's interesting. It's different. And you'll either love it or find it bland. And so you should try it out sometime if you want. Okay, it's about time to wrap it up, but I'm not going to wrap it up yet. I just kind of wanted to mention, simply out of chance the other day, I went and tried Record My Desktop. A lot of you have probably heard of Record My Desktop. It's been around for a while. I've heard of it. I'd heard it was good and that it was easy, and I just never really had a chance to use it or a reason to try it, to be honest. And I recently came into a new laptop that is quite powerful, and I was doing a screencast for a friend, and I decided, well, let's try Record My Desktop, just because, I mean, FFmpeg is what I usually use, but FFmpeg was a fairly large install that I wasn't really sure that I wanted to embark upon. I was running a live thumb drive, and I just didn't feel, I wasn't 100% sure that I had enough, space on this, like, in this live environment. I think I probably did. I have 16 gigs of RAM or something, so I think I probably did, but for some reason, I kind of felt like I should try to go with something simpler. So I installed Record My Desktop. It was a quick install, very small, and it's super easy. It really, really was a pleasure to use. I was really surprised. It's a command line application. There is a GUI version of it called Qt Record My Desktop or Q Record My Desktop, something like that, which I've not used. But the command line version is quite simple. It's Record My Desktop, and then you hit return. And I think by default it outputs the file as out.ogv. But you can look at the man page and find out different options as well. For instance, I passed the no sound flag and gave it a different output destination again because I was on a live thumb drive. So I had to make sure that my output was going to another thumb drive so that I didn't run out of space. So you can do that. There's lots of other options too. I mean, you can change the size of your recording area, you can give it a delay, different things like that. Just look at the man page. It's really, really simple to understand. And it's a simple application to use. I mean, it really is. You type in the word record my desktop, or the string record my desktop, and it starts recording your desktop. I was really, really amazed at the performance. I mean, I think part of that is because of the laptop that I'm using now. But the other part of it is that Record My Desktop just does the job quite well, and it doesn't encode on the fly. So it is just doing essentially a raw dump of, everything that you're doing on your desktop. And then after you're finished, it starts encoding what you have just recorded. That, in a way, was a little bit annoying to me because I kind of wanted to be able to decide whether it was going to encode on the fly or whether it was going to do it later, and then I got annoyed that it started encoding the thing when I just made a mistake and what I really wanted to do was stop it so that I could edit out later. You know, little things like that kind of got on my nerves, but all told, like, the overall experience was really, really good. And I think looking back, that even when I was annoyed, I think it was mostly just because I was being impatient. And the application itself, I highly recommend. If you're doing screencasting, if you feel like you just want something to, you know, that you can just turn on and just have it work, this was quite nice. I highly recommend it. So I did record my desktop with all the different options. I ended up with two different files, AUG video files, Theora, and then I imported those into FlowBlade, cut them down a little bit here and there just to cover up some mistakes, you know, that I'd made that would distract the viewer, and exported it back out. Did a couple of different compression passes to make sure that I was getting, you know, the best quality for file size, and it worked like a charm. It was really, really nice. Check it out if you have not used it yet. If you're looking for a screen recording solution that's simple, fast, and efficient, that's one that I would probably look at first. Okay, I think that's it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening, as always. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or at SlackerMedia.info. You can find me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And you can also find me on linuxquestions.org as notklaatu. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.